Okay, the fourth aliyah of Vayetzeh is a lot that goes on in a short space. And just to give a little bit of an introduction to one of the themes in this aliyah, and that ties into a lot, and maybe it'll give a little bit of context. It ties into some of what happened in last week's parsha as well. So there is a question that the Rishonim deal with about one of the central contexts of this week's parsha, and especially of this aliyah. And it has to do with the fact that Yaakov is married to two sisters, which is against the Torah, and that shouldn't be a problem, except that we also have a premise that the Avos followed the entire Torah, that the Avos kept the Torah. So if that's the case, how could Yaakov be permitted to marry two sisters? And there are various answers in the Rishonim. And one approach I think it's possible to take, and that impacts a lot of what happens in Sefer Bereishis, and connects to some themes that we talked about recently, is that the idea of the Avos keeping the Torah by necessity has to come not from commandment. We know that they weren't commanded, that this wasn't coming as a function of tzivoy, but rather as a function of them working to try to understand the Ratzon Hashem and intuiting what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants, and therefore choosing to follow it. And that is a part of their godless, that they did that, that Avram started this path, and that's something that Chazal, the Gemara Maseches Yuma, interprets from the pasuk in the first Aliyah in last week's Parsha, and Parsha's told us, Ekev Asher Shama Avram Bekoli, that Avram listened, Bikol Hashem, listened to not just that which was stated, but also to that which was between the lines. He was able to discern the will of God. So that attention to the Ratzon Hashem was manifest in following God's will in addition to his explicit words. So that is how he comes to follow the words of the Torah even before they were actually given. A question already?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I've heard an answer. I actually had a big machlokes and I remember it last year, yes, in Rutgers, but yeah, so.
We'll say more. I mean,
all right, fine. All right.
We'll come to that. Let's just to try to set the field, set the stage a little bit, and see some more answers. But here, just as far as this approach is concerned, so it seems that the idea of the Avos keeping the Torah is based on them understanding the reasoning for it. And if that's the case, so even though we assume that we are not permitted to be Darish time of the Torah, we're not allowed to base our observance on the reasoning or what we believe to be the reasoning, that's because we have a tzivui. We are commanded to observe the Torah as halachos, as rules. But the Avos didn't have a tzivui. So therefore, it's more legitimate for the Avos to go based on the reasoning, or what they perceive to be the reasoning. That's how they come to it in the first place. So there's more of a legitimacy for them to be Dorish time of the Kra, because they don't have a Kra. They only have the time, but they only have the reasoning. So if that's the case, so it would be more reasonable for Yaakov to marry two sisters, because he could be Doresh, the taima of the later Kra, that the reason the Torah doesn't want you to marry two sisters is because the assumption is there'll be sibling rivalry, and that itself will create a unhappy household. But if that is indeed the case, so perhaps he could assume that in this situation, these two sisters, here you see that Rachel gives Leah the simanim at this time of their marriage, and there's such a bond of love and connection between them, so he has the right to assume that there isn't going to be rival between them, and I'll take the questions in a second, and therefore perhaps that is legitimate to, in this situation, to marry the two of them. It wasn't l'chachila anyway, he didn't choose to, but since the circumstances worked out, that he ended up needing to marry both of them, it was understandable and legitimate to believe that there wasn't going to be the feared rivalry between them, and that could be understandable. So there's a lot to say and to explore about that, and I think that understanding could impact a lot, including a lot about last week's parsha, but that's for a different time. Also a lot about this week's parsha. But perhaps what you're going to ask is, so what about this aliyah, where it does seem that there is quite a lot of tension between Rachel and Leah. So this is why I'm bringing it up now, because this is the Geder introduction to this Aliyah. So a part of it is going to be a question how to understand the interaction that we're going to see between Rachel and Leah. And the interaction does seem somewhat hostile or somewhat tense, but it's worth reading the interpretation, the commentary of Rav Hirsch, who suggests that it's more of a banter, and that this is actually reflective of the intense love between Rachel and Leah, and that this is kind of a joking interaction that they have between each other. It's more of a banter, and that it shouldn't be taken as hostility. So whether or not that's the case, it's certainly subject to interpretation, but just wanted to mention that before we actually go into the Psukim, and it certainly is a difficult story to understand on many levels, but just to place that there, it's possible that Yaakov's interpretation and his understanding of their relationship was perhaps incorrect, or it's also possible that this ends up being a reinforcement of the message of the Torah and the wisdom of not being Darish Time Dekra, and to understand that even when we think there are exceptions, that we should appreciate the wisdom of not making exceptions. So there could be multiple lessons here. It could be that Yaakov was right in his assessment of Rachel and Leah's relationship. It could be he was wrong. It could be that ultimately that's why we're not supposed to be Darish Tani Dekra. There could be many different ways to understand exactly what's going on here, but just it's noteworthy that perhaps maybe this could explain why Yaakov felt it was mutter to marry two sisters. Maybe it does reflect your relationship. Maybe it doesn't. Many different possible ways of understanding this, but that's just one note to keep in mind as we begin this Aliyah. Is that your question?
Part of it. I mean, okay. I have another question too.
Okay.
Why is Leah viewed as a tzedekah?
Well, she's tzedekah for a lot of reasons. She does a lot of wonderful things. But is your question, you don't think she's a tzedekah because of...
I'm not saying I don't think she is. I'm saying I know she is, but I want to understand more of why.
I mean, she's for her whole life. Why are you... where's the question coming from?
Most of what we know about her is this is the sibling rivalry romantic triangle, which is never healthy between her and Rachel and Yaakov. She seems, and while the reasons for everything she does are completely understandable, that doesn't make what she does right.
Well, it's also important to appreciate that it doesn't make...
Why does she have the right to steal her sister's husband? Why does she have the right to...
Did she choose to steal him?
She went along with it.
So...
This is marriage. This isn't, like, Rabbi Feldman discussed. This is, like, the biggest decision of your life.
The other option was... Seemingly she was forced by her father. She's...
The other option... So that's another consideration. The other option was Esau, but she could have just also married someone. Why was... That also gets into the question of why she was destined for Yaakov, but why couldn't she marry someone else?
So these are important questions also to appreciate, that it doesn't necessarily take away from your tzidkus to have complex emotions.
No, that's not what I was saying. Right. But where in the Torah do you see examples of her being
a tzedekah? So what we do see is, and especially with the commentaries of Chazal, is her she'ifa to be connected to Avodas Hashem and to great things and to building the nation of God. And that's actually one of the major themes in this Aliyah specifically. And that this is part of what was a component of her desire to marry Yaakov in the first place, and a part of Chazal's commentary about Ene Leah Rakos and why she was crying about the thought of being married to Esav, and the notion that she desired to be a part of this great family and to be connected to what Yaakov was a part of and what Avram's family was a part of, and that this was how she wanted to live and who she wanted to be. So that itself is tzidkus. And the fact that there is a tension and the fact that there is a complexity in those aspirations, so that does not take away from tzidkus. It doesn't take away from the ratzon to be somebody great and to be devoted to great things.
Well, I wasn't taking... No, that's a very noble goal, but I wasn't... I wasn't saying that the things that she does makes her not a tzedekah. As I said, those are understandable. But... and that we can debate whether it was right or wrong, what she did. But where do we have the clear, explicit examples of her being a tzedekah?
So I would start with that.
Most people want to do well in life, and
but we talk about doing well. We're talking about the desire to build the Am Hashem. We're talking about the
desire. How did she know that that was building? I mean,
this is certainly the idea that Chazal is describing throughout, and in Achanam, a lot of it is coming
through. Where does it say in the Tanakh that like she knew that she was?
So in Achanam, a lot of it is coming from Torah Shebaal Peh, but this is certainly what Chazal are understanding through the Masorah, that, and that's one of the major themes in this Aliyah specifically, as we'll end up discussing. That her desire to be building Yaakov Shvatim, which is one of the major themes specifically of what we're going to see here, and to be connected to this mission. So that is a she'ifa for Avoda. That is a she'ifa for building the service of God and for spreading His message. That is the definition of tzidkus. And it's also a feeling that she had a right to be doing so. There's certainly not a perception, as we'll also see, that she's doing anything wrong. And the feeling that Adarava, that she was being herself the mistreated. And that's also something that we'll see a little bit of. Did you?
I mean, two things, but I relate to that. I mean, the Shvatim as well. Like, where do we see, I mean, in we don't really see in the Pesukim that they were, the only thing we know about them is that they sold their brother and almost killed him.
And they pay a price for that. We say there's no question that part of what we see in, say, Sefer Bereishis is that tzidkus is not a contradiction to complexity.
Right, but it doesn't highlight. It only highlights the negative side of the complexity.
And the Torah Shebichtav.
The Torah Shebichtav.
But they did all stand up for their sister Dina.
I mean, for two shvatim, but also that was pretty radical. I mean,
and is it? Too close to stand up to your sister?
Well, especially that is also presented.
They
wiped out an entire city.
That is also specifically presented negatively. That Yaakov repeatedly
condemned. Well, it's Tushvatim who did the actual killing.
But
all
that is that with Leia.
Well, we're going to lose a little bit of
rage.
Can I ask a different question? When Yaakov's looking at the reason for the mitzvah and deciding based on it, like, the assumption is, like, at least in the reason given, was that there's one reason to the mitzvah. Like, it would seem, though, that there, like, the mitzvah could be multidimensional, and, like isolating one reason for the mitzvah might be, like, lacking somehow.
So, in general, that's a problem of being Darish Time of the Kra, and that's a part of it. So, one of the reasons why we're not given the license to be Darish Time of the Kra is that. So, there's a lot to discuss about that. But however, when we get into the topic of the Avos being the kind of the Torah, which is itself a challenging concept, so by necessity it seems that we have to come to it from a time of the Kra perspective, because where are they getting the Torah from if not from their intuition and understanding of it? So it seems that there's precedent for this in Svarim, that they have the license to work off that understanding of where it comes from.
So like, I understand that for like some of the mitzvahs, but then when you talk about like, or like when one talks about like them like keeping Pesach, like that had to be, you could
right.
Like
the
that
question
Pesach, like a moral intuition that seems like a nevuah and
that
is because you sat in a hut when you left.
Yeah, that is particularly complicated. So the question of which mitzvahs they fulfilled and which mitzvahs they didn't fulfill is itself a discussion. There's extensive literature about this. When it comes to Pesach, so you're probably referring specifically to the references to matzah. And matzah, in particular, the Beis Halevi and others, is all literature about whether matzah is because of the chipazon of Yetzias Mitzrayim, or it's the other way around, Yetzias Mitzrayim is because of the chipazon. So there's a lot to say about that. I'm a little worried if we spend too much time on this, we're not going to get to any of the psukim. So I'm probably going to try to redirect towards the rest of the psukim. Is it about the...
Just quick, is it the Ramban that says that they only kept the Yaseis and the Los Yaseis?
No, it's the Gorariyeh. But the Ramban talks about the mitzvahs only in Eretz Yisrael specifically. But, okay, but let's try to look at the actual psukim. There's a lot more to say about those topics. But in any event, so the psukim, we'll look at some of the psukim at least. So the psukim begin here. So Vayelech Ruvein Bimeit Tzirchitim. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Dab Tzaditas talks about why the emphasis here is that it's the Tzirchitim that were being harvested. And the Gemara says that this is to tell us that Shavach of Tzadikim, that lo poshtim midayim begezel, that they don't take anything that's not theirs. So that's interesting on a couple of levels here. So first of all, what does this guy do with Gezel? How is he telling this about Gezel or not? So Rashi has two interpretations. Rashi over here in Chumash, Rashi says that this is to show that they took something else, that Reuven was going to take Gedoyim, Dover Hefker, Sheino de Makripo. So this is not what he's being harvested. Well, Rashi in the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that they waited until everyone else took their stuff and then he went in. So Moshe Feinstein has a comment in his Sefer Darsh Moshe that you would think that if you're a tzaddik, so at a minimum that means that you don't steal. So why is this such a chiddush that the Torah has to point out that they're not makbid on Gezel? Now, first you could say cynically that halavai, that it was such a given that that's what it means to be a tzaddik. And unfortunately, we've seen that sometimes it's not so obvious to people that you have to be makbid on Gezel, and there are sometimes a couple of maybe even not so cynical reasons, like the Gemara says in the Chulin, that you could actually derive from Yaakov himself, that tzaddikim mamonim chavivim aleim yosim megufam. So that's a discussion in Parashas Vayishlach, which has its own context to it, so you might have some good reason to wonder about that. But overall, really, we should think that tzaddikim are, at a minimum, makpidim on Gezel. So as Rav Moshe points out, and probably that's Pashup Shad here as well, that this is not the obvious kind of Gezel, that what presumably the point here is that this is an extra kind of Kveda, that they're very, very careful to not even come close to Gezel and to not do anything that may impact on the mamonos of others, and therefore the Torah is giving us an extra awareness of this, and this is something to appreciate. So Reuven found these dudayim, he found these mandrakes, and v'yavei osam aleha. So he brings them to Leah Imo, to his mother, and the Rishonim have different understandings why he thought this was a good idea. He thought this was maybe a school of her fertility, even though she already had a number of sons, but the Torah says she had paused, she had stopped at that point. So maybe there was a belief that the Rishonim discussed, there was a belief that was apparently an incorrect belief, but a belief that this was some kind of a skula to have more children. So maybe that was what he was thinking, or he thought that she would like them, or he thought that Yaakov would like them, various theories that have shown him why he did this. But he brought this to Leah, but Tomer Rachel Leah, Tanina li mi dudai b'nech. So Leah tells her, give me your son's dudayim. So here's the line, which is very subject to interpretation on many levels, whether, like Rav Hirsch, do you see this as banter, or do you see this as conveying some real tension between them? But however you interpret it, so she says back to her, V'komer la, hama'at karteches ishi, it's not enough that you took my husband. So first of all, what does that mean? You took my husband, so he's still married to both of them. So here, the Rishonim discuss, the assumption is that Yaakov is spending more time with Rachel at this point, and the Rishonim discuss why that is, perhaps connected to the fact that Rachel doesn't have children, various theories in the Rishonim, what this is a reference to. And you want to take my son's flowers also. Okay, so we'll trade. So they'll take him tonight. So as was indicated by the question before, so this claim, however we interpret it, and of course that's going to be relevant, but this accusation that Rachel is taking Leah's husband, so one could go back to history here and say, who took him first? So I understand that that's on your mind. So Ruchem Lubavitz, among others, discusses this, and he comes from a wholly different perspective than you're coming from, and he suggests that this is actually the Amida of Tzadikim, coming from a very different perspective you're coming from, that their emuna is such that they assume that the way things happen are the way they're meant to be. So therefore, her premise is that this was the default, and that she was the one married to him, and therefore any intrusion in that is considered to be a taking. Now, one could see it like that. There are other reasons also for her to believe. We know the whole perspective that the Lavan had brought into the equation, that she was the older one, and therefore that was the Derech HaOlam. However, we understand that there was some reason for her to believe that she was destined for him, and that Rachel was the one who was intruding. And now, apparently, on some level, she felt that, again, Rachel is intruding, and that comment seems to reflect that. So again, could clearly argue back and forth, but whether this is a serious comment, whether this is a more harsh kind of comment, whether her take on the previous history is reasonable or not, but that there's various levels of interpretation, and that's how she responds to this point. Probably not Kedai for us to spend time going back and forth about it. We'll probably Kedai for us to move on to this point. We'll come back to it. Okay, so in any event, the next pasuk tells us that so v'yavo Yaakov ben Hasada v'erev v'teitzele l'krosom v'tomer elai tavo ki sachors chartich b'tudoi b'ni v'yishkav yuma b'lai lahu. So Leah comes out, and she tells Yaakov what the arrangement is, and indeed, so he comes to her that night. So this language of Vateitse Leah, so Leah goes out to him, so that has interpretations, just like we said before, interpretations that are positive and negative. It goes to your question, how do you see Leah's character? So Chazal see this as both negative and positive, her outgoing nature here has been interpreted both negatively and positively. So Chazal do say, the Gemara in Erevin on Dav Kuf, that this was, like I was saying before, an expression of her desire to contribute in a continuing way to the building of the Shvatim and to be a part of building this nation. So she wanted to have more children with Yaakov and with more children of the Shvat of the Shiftei Hashem. So that was her intention here. So that should be seen positively. And indeed, so what comes from this is Yisachar, the Koach of Torah. And this idea of Yitzia, of an outgoing Koach, and this is something that she's able to pass on to him, and that's necessary for the Koach of Torah. But we also find that the Tanchuma sees this as kind of a pritzus, and the Tanchuma tells us that that's why in the Parshas Vayishlach, we see Dina associated with Leah. I'm going to go ahead with this. Sorry. We can see Dina. I probably could have just move ahead. We see, forgive me, it's just, I think we're not going to get to the further psukim. Please be mochel. But, that you see that Dina is associated with Leah in that sense, in a negative sense, that she's called Yatsanis, just like Leah is called here. And that ends up having negative consequences for her. So how do you understand that if here Chazal are specifically telling us that this is something that is praiseworthy about Leah? So this is something that the Rosh Yeshiva of Karen Biavna or Goldberg spoke about at length. And he talked about the fact that this is an important principle to understand as far as Chinuch is concerned, that children see the external expressions of the parents, and they're not necessarily always aware of what the motivations are. So if there is something that is externally, superficially pretzistic about this activity, so the fact that it is motivated from a holy place, the fact that it represents a tshuka that is kodesh, is not going to be passed down to the children. So all the children see are the externals. They only see what is represented on the outside. And therefore, that is something the parents always have to be aware of, that it could be that there is a positive motivation, but that's not necessarily going to be what the children pick up on, and that's true about everything. That's true whether it's anger that is expressed externally, it's true if it's kanos, it's true if it's cynicism, if it's negativity, if it's a harshness, anything that is expressed externally, even if it comes from a place of holiness, it comes from some kind of a good motivation, that what is expressed externally is going to be what the children are going to see, and that's going to impact on their character, and that's something that the parents very much have to be aware of. This is also relevant to the name Yisachar, which is influenced by this whole history. And here, the second part of the pasuk, so here has Leah has says ki sachor sachartich, so that double language, and pasuk yudches vatomer Leah nasan elokim sachari eshenasati shevchasi liishi. There's another reference there, vatikra shmo yisachar or Yisaskar. It's a whole discussion how to pronounce his name, and some understand that it's pronounced differently in different psukim. It's a whole discussion in and of itself. And the Radak points out here, there's a remez here, Yisachar is Yesh Schar, Yesh Schar Vakulaseich. And the Pasuk here has two usages of Schar. So here the Pasuk references Asher Nasati Shefchasili Ishi. That's itself a whole discussion. But also the previous Pasuk uses the word Schar twice. So the Rishonim, and later Meforshim as well, the Chasam Sofer, the Schwab has discussion about this, that at least one of the schar here is a reference to something which really should be tsanua, this idea of her hiring out her husband. So therefore, perhaps the idea that despite the fact that the word has two shins, the more common pronunciation of it as if there's only one sin, one shin of Yisachar rather than Yisaskar, is perhaps a reference to that idea that it should be pronounced in a tsanua way, as if there's only one shin, to represent the idea that one of the schiros here is a little bit more tsanua. Okay, so Vatar Odeya Vatele Ben Shishu Liakov. So then she has another son, and that's Zvulun. So Vatom Raleya's Vadani Elokim Osi Zevet Tov Hapam Yizbaleni Yishi Kilarati Lo Shisha Vanim Vatikra Eshmo Zvulun. So she has this next son, Zvulun, and the idea of these two sons in quick succession here, Yisachar and Zvulun, so this evokes the notion of the very close Yisachar-Zvulun relationship, and the idea that there is a strong bond between the two of them, and the notion of Hachzakas Talmud Torah that's represented by Yisachar and Zvulun, Yisachar of the Torah scholarship and Zvulun of the Avoda, and there's a whole history that has developed from that of the support of Torah and the different versions that have existed, different agreements. It's interesting to know, we talk about tzedakah and priorities in tzedakah. It's really different definitions of what we mean by tzedakah. Tzedakah really means to help aniyim. And when we talk about the things that we're supposed to spend money on and how we prioritize we spend money on, so there are different halachic purposes. They're not really all called tzedakah. They have different kinds of categories to them. Sometimes they are of assistance, and sometimes there are mitzvos that we need to perform, and sometimes we perform them directly, and sometimes we bring them about through our resources. So we can't do everything ourselves, and some mitzvos need to be performed through financial support. So schools need to be built, and mikvos need to be built, and other things need to happen through financial support. So Yisachar's Zvulun relationship represents that. Every mitzvah has the component of the physical performance, and also everything that needs to happen in order for it to be supported. So all of that is equally significant as far as the mitzvah. Remember, I mentioned a minute ago, Rishi Karen Vyavna. Remember him telling us once when one of the major supporters of the yeshiva was going to visit, and he wanted to make sure before he came that we would understand the chashivas of his visit, and he told us that just as if the Chazon Ish would visit, he had been a Talmud of the Chazon Ish, that if the Chazon Ish would visit, we would all meet him at the bus stop and come dance him down at the Beis Medrash, so too, this supporter also. And the whole notion that they are equally responsible for the Torah that is happening. So that idea of the Yisachar-Zvulun relationship is one that has been transmitted through the generations. And perhaps also, it's a little bit symbolized here, that the lopsided nature of how many of the Shvatim came through Leah, that has a lot to be said, but specifically that Yisachar and Zvulun happened to be from the same mother, that part of the close relationship between the two of them and the equation and the value between the two of them is also a part of the imagery. This next pasuk, the pasuk of Aleph, a very brief pasuk, you would not believe how much very significant, very high stakes halacha l'maisa is connected to this pasuk. You would be quite shocked. This pasuk says, "Ve'achar yalda bas v'tikra es shema dina." I'll throw it out there if anyone can guess, like what hugely significant, high stakes halachic discussions are connected to this.
It's and she called her name, so who gets to like name the child? Is that
so? that's a fair guess, but there are any number of psukim that could be relevant to that, and that's not as high stakes. Jonathan?
For Ravu, whether you have to have a son and a daughter?
Also not. Yeah.
Praying for the gender of a child.
Okay, that was closest, but that is closest.
Changing the gender of a child.
Okay, closer.
Like
praying for something after it happens.
What? Also, that's also right. Those were actually the last three were closer, but it even gets more than that. So those last three were all correct, and there's more. So those three were all correct, and there's more than that. Yes.
Praying
so what's
the gender of a child?
Sorry.
Praying for the gender of a child.
Yes, that was said, and that was correct, and there's actually more to it. So what's going on here? So. The name Dina, the Gemara in Maseches Brachos on Daf Samach and Aleph, tells us that she's called Dina because there was a diyun here. There was some kind of judgment involved that she figured out through the Ruach HaKodesh. And again, this goes to the Tzidkus of Leia on a number of levels. Right? Because here, we see that this connects to, there's a lot that tells here about the Tzidkus of Leia because it connects to her concern about the Shvatim, about her concern about her sister, which goes back to our original point, and also about her sensitivity. But she knew through Ruach HaKodesh, which also requires her to be a tzaddik, that there were going to be 12 shvatim. And apparently she was pregnant and expecting to have a boy. So if there's going to be 12 shvatim, and the shvachos already had 4, so that means she had 6. So if she's going to have a 7th, so that leaves only 1 for Rachel to have. So that means she was going to have less than the Shvachos, so that means that was going to be a bizayon for her. So Leah prayed for that situation to change. So that's what this din represents. So the Gemara Maseches Brachos brings this up in that context. So yes, those last three suggestions were all correct. That one of the Halacha L'maisa discussions was, first of all, the question of tefillah shav. Yes, so that the Gemara there discusses that can you daven for something that's already determined? And the Gemara tells us that one should not daven for something that already is, that's already b'metzius. It's called the tefillah shav. So, for example, if you hear a fire engine, you hear a siren, and you were to daven, I hope it's not my house, so that's not an appropriate tefillah, because whatever is already, the fire truck's already on the way to some existing fire, so it doesn't make sense to daven that it shouldn't be your house. Well, hold on a second. So in that context, the Gemara talks about davening, your wife is pregnant, you're davening that it should be one gender or the other. So in that context, the Gemara says, well, what about this, that we have this tradition, that's what happened, that Leia was expecting a boy and it turned into a girl. So apparently it is possible to have such a tefillah. So that's why you were correct about these issues, that first of all, the issue of davening about something that is already set, that's one of the halachic concerns. And the question about davening for the gender of a child is also prompted by this issue. Now what's a little bit ambiguous about that Gemara and affects the question of davening for gender also is that by necessity that Gemara is subject to human perception, because when do you define when something is set and when it isn't set? That's also a little bit hard to know. Hi.
Gemara, I pulled up here as far, used the word shedana leya din ba'atma. Is that davening?
Well, it sounds like she was also making a calculation. It's talking about the fact that she was assessing the situation and saying, okay, given that this is how the facts lay out, so what are we going to do? So, in that context, so those are among the issues, but it was also, this is also invoked, as serious as those issues are, those are significant halachic issues, but this has also been brought in contemporary literature for some very high-stake issues beyond this. So, in order to appreciate that, you also have to be aware that there is a little bit of a difference in traditions in exactly what went on. It sounds like from that Gemara and Brachos, that there was a gender switch, which is also a significant discussion in halacha today, as we know. But there are different traditions as to what exactly happened. So it sounds like from the Gemara over there that the Vlad was a boy and turned into a girl. But there are other mesoros that something different happened, that Rachel and Leah were both pregnant at the time, and that Rachel had been carrying a girl and Leah had been carrying a boy, and somehow they switched. So the baby that Rachel was carrying and the baby that Leah was carrying switched places. So for that reason, so the context in which this is evoked is the issue of uterine transplants or surrogacy or ovarian transplants. So there is a significant literature about this. The Sicily Ezer has a tshuva about this. My friend, the highly capable rabbi and doctor, Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman Shlita, has an article about this. It was written in Tradition last year. Rabbi Reichman is capable in many fields, in addition to his excellent articles, which are very well researched and of wonderful content. He also has a terrific sense of humor, so if I'm not mistaken, the title of this article was Sarachiyam Medina, and you can understand why. And he quotes there, some want to bring a raya from here, that if you have contributions from various women to a child, so you have an ovary from one mother, but the child is actually born from another mother, that there is some want to bring a raya that if the ovary is from one mother, that's the mother. Because part of what prompts the discussion, they quote the Paneach Raza, that the question is a tradition that Shimon married Dina. So how could Shimon marry his sister, both from Leah? So if the answer is that Dina was really the child of Rachel, and only a half-sister makes it better, so that's a raya that really you go after where the ovary comes from. But others point out, if anything, there's a raya fakert, because the Torah calls Dina the daughter of Leah, so maybe it's a raya that you go after the birth mother. So there's an extensive literature about this. Rabbi Reichman's article is highly recommended. It was in Tradition. I don't remember exactly when, but you can Google for it. The Tradition archives are online. After he wrote his article, there was a sefer that came out called the Sifsei Shimon. Has a sefer Al Torah, his sefer on Parshas Vayetze. He has an article where he quotes many ramifications of this. It's all very fascinating. Caleb?
Two questions. Number one, didn't almost all the Shvatim marry their twin sisters?
There's a lot to talk about that. So the whole question about...
I mean, that would... If the twin sister would clearly be from the same mother.
Right. So what exactly to do with that? That's a much longer discussion. But,
and then number... Question number two. Can we make halacha based on a midrash?
That's a fair question also. So the whole discipline and the whole genre of halacha from the Yukim is a fair question. There is a very extensive literature that does so, and there's a very extensive literature questioning that literature. So that's also for a separate discussion. You could get a PhD analyzing that literature. But here also you see some of the challenges of some of those Yukim. Okay, so just to make one or two other points. So Yosef is born after this. And so the Torah tells us that Vayizkor Lekim Es Rachel, Vayishma Eleha Lekim, Vayivtach Es Rachma. And of course, it's not that God forgot, but that Rachel seemed to be forgotten, seemed to be neglected. Vatar Vatelet Bang, Vatomer Asaf Lekim Es Karpasi. So she became pregnant and she had a son. And she says that God has collected, has gathered up my embarrassment. Here the Ramban writes, that's from a language of, he brought in my cherpa, people will not talk about me anymore, I won't be the subject of discussion. Rashi also quotes a pshat here, which is very difficult to understand. It's clearly not the main reason people have children, we would hope, but Rashi quotes the idea that now I have somebody to blame things on. That sometimes people go, when it goes wrong, you can say, yeah, it wasn't me, it was the kid. So it's very hard to understand. Rav Simcha Zussel Roy, say for Sam Derech, he says that this is to show that when you have Hakar Satov, you recognize that even the very small details of what's good is something that you are able to acknowledge and to thank. So that's Pshat, as he quotes the author of Slobodka, that you say that the Anosa Masech Vivina, that we thank God for giving understanding to the rooster. So this is not really the kind of understanding that's going to change the world, that's going to build the iPhone. But the point is that even the smallest degree of Bina is something to recognize and to be grateful for. And that's where everything else is built on top of. So that's how we show that we're actually grateful. That's what we are able to acknowledge. The notion also the name here, so there's more to it. So it says, "Vahi Chasher Yolder Achlas Yosef Yomer Yaakov Yolder Shalchini De'ochel Makom Ba'arzi." Okay, so after this, she says she wants the one, but I skipped the pasuk. Sorry. So right before this, Dikra Shmo Yosef Leimor Yosef Hashem Li Ben Acher. So she also, after she says Asaf Hashem Chapasi, she goes on to say that she actually calls his name Yosef, and she says that Yosef, I want that God will give me another son. So here the Torah is giving us two different reasons for the name. So there's a discussion here in the Avi Nachal about why the Avi Nachal is the Sefer of Drashos, of Baal HaLubushi Esrad. So he explains why there's different reasons here. And she he suggests that she was giving this reason of she wants another son, because that was coming from her Ruach HaKodesh of understanding how the Shvatim were going to play out. And that was not going to be what she was going to publicly tell people. This wasn't going to be the speech she was going to give at the Bris. So, therefore, the idea of Asas V'Hashem Esker Pasi, so that was what was more publicly discussed. So the Torah gives us both names. And that's sometimes what you find, that there are different reasons to what's actually in people's intentions. Some things are discussed publicly, some things are what is actually in mind when people give a name, and that's fine. Not everything is always for public consumption. Some things are meant to be said out loud, some things are actually a part of what the parents have in mind, and there are many examples of this. We'll just end on the note of the last pasuk. So here, Lavan is telling Yaakov, he should stay. Yaakov is saying, now my family, Yosef, now that Rachel has had a child also, so, and I've completed, and the Forshim understand, now I've completed the 7 years that I committed to work for her, so now I'd like to leave, and Lavan is saying, I'd like you to stay. And he ends off, the Aliyah ends off on these words, that I realize I have been blessed through you. And that notion that the Jews should be a source of bracha, should be recognized as a source of bracha. So this is a reminder of our obligation to be a Kiddush Hashem to the world, and to be recognized as a Kiddush Hashem to the world, and that that should be perceived, that should be understood. So this is a good note to end on. It should be a bracha to us, and we should read this Aliyah, and we should be inspired this Shabbos to be a continuing Kiddush Hashem, and that the message of the Avos, with all of their complexity and with all of the tensions that sometimes arose in the context of that complexity, should be a continued inspiration, that the Sheifa to convey the message of God to the world through the context of all of the challenges and all of the tensions that sometimes arise does not have to get in the way, and does not have to be an impediment to Sitkus and to bringing that message. And may we continue to be a Kiddush Hashem and to be a source of bracha and to overcome all of the challenges that
have a wonderful Shabbos.